So we have talked a little bit about the mystics' recognition of the feminine dimension of God. And now we should consider, what is the feminine role in prophecy, in the revelation of the divine word? And here we immediately encounter the concept of the Shekinah, which is so prevalent in the mystical theory of Kabbalah, which is found in the Zohar, and which Gershom Scholem, the great Kabbalist scholar, tells us is the equivalent of Goethe's eternal feminine. In the Talmud, Shekinah represents the tangible presence of God. Not God in the abstract, but God tangibly, palpably present on earth. So God's presence on Mount Sinai, God's presence in the temple, and particularly God's presence as dwelling, resting upon the prophets. This Shekinah, this feminine divine presence, is that which rests upon the prophets. And it is also in this context known as the Ruach HaKodesh, or in Arabic, the Ruach al-Quds, the Holy Spirit through which the prophets speak. So the prophetic speech is animated by this feminine emanation of the presence of God. Now this Ruach HaKodesh or Ruach al-Quds makes its appearance in Surat al-Qadr, in the Quran Sharif, where the night of power is described. And remember, night is the phase of day that is presided over by the moon. And in those very ancient effigies of the feminine divinity, she was shown holding the crescent moon. There is an innate correspondence between women, the myths of women's fertility and the cycles of the moon. And of course, there is an innate biological correspondence between the moon and women's cycles. And the moon in its, the sun is perpetual in its light, but the moon waxes and wanes. And so the moon symbolizes the cycle of life and death. And this is a cycle that historically, mythologically, has been deeply associated with women's experience of the sacred. And so this surah is a surah about the night. And remember, who in the civilization of Islam personifies the night? It is Layla. Layla, who is the beloved of Majnun, the archetypal beloved. So night, the feminine, it carries many resonances. But in the course of this surah, night is shown to be the special time when something descends from the angelic planes and comes down into earth, into manifestation. And that which descends on this night of power is the hosts of the angels and the Ruh al-Quds, the Holy Spirit. A'udhu billahi minash shaitani rajim, bismillahi rahmani rahim. Inna anzalnahu fi laylatul qadr, wa ma adraka ma laylatul qadr. Laylatul qadr khairun min alf shahr. تنزل الملائكة وروح فيها بإذن ربهم من كل أمر سلام هي حتى مطلع الفجر. صدق الله العلي العظيم. Truly we caused it to descend on the night of power. And what will explain the night of power? the night of power is better than 1,000 months. In it, we cause to descend the angels and the Ruh al-Quds, the Holy Spirit, on every task. Salamun hiya hatta matla al-fajr. She is peace. That night is peace until the break of dawn. Now this spirit that descends on the prophets is called in the Quran the Sakina, which is the Arabic form of the word Shakina, the Sakina. It is said in Surah Tawbah, God sent his Sakina on the prophets and on the faithful. And it is said in Surah Baqarah, the phrase is mentioned, At-tabut fihi sakina, which can be translated as an ark filled with the sakina, because the Ark of the Covenant held that feminine emanation that is the sakina. But it is also interpreted by commentators to mean a heart full of tranquility, because sakina also means tranquil presence. And so the great mystic Shahabuddin Yahya Suhrawardi uses this word sakina to speak about a certain mystical experience. This mystical experience is between two other experiences. The first stage is that of flashing lights, sudden rapturous ecstasies which dissipate as quickly as they have appeared. Those are the lawaya. But there's a second, a further stage where light subsists, clarity indwells and remains steadily. And he calls this experience sakina, the tranquil abiding of light in the heart. And beyond that, of course, there's still a further stage which he calls the effacing light. But this intermediary experience, he calls it the light of sakina. And he quotes the verse of the Quran, Bidhikrullahi tatma'inul qulub. Through the remembrance of God, hearts know tranquility. The heart becomes serene. So we can see that according to the Kabbalists and according to the Sufis, based on their deep study of the Bible and of the Quran, the spirit that animates prophecy is a feminine spirit. But that leads us on now to a further question. If the function of prophecy is feminine, who are the women prophets? What is the role of actual historical women in the transmission of the divine truth? And here again, if we study the exoteric history of the religions, we find much dispiriting, disheartening information. We find evidence of something of a conspiracy to cover over the contributions of illuminated women. However, beneath the accumulated occlusion, we can find traces of the significance of women's roles in the transmission of the divine truth. So if we turn to the Indic civilization, of course, there are several great cycles of revelation that revealed the prophetic spirit in the Indian subcontinent. And yet, in India, as elsewhere, very often it is the male mythological figures that predominate. We hear the most about Rama, Krishna, Shiva, and Buddha. And we would like to know more about Sita, Radha, Parvati, and Tara, among others. But when we do investigate, we find that each of these feminine figures is no mere accidental counterpart, but is significant, each in her own right. In the case of Sita, we know that her personality precedes that, historically precedes that of Rama. She is mentioned in the Vedas, where Rama is not. She is of an earlier significance. Her name means furrow. She is a chthonic feminine figure associated with the earth. She is, it is said in the Ramayana, born from the earth. Now, in much of the Ramayana, she seems to be merely the passive victim of circumstances, while the champion of the narrative appears to be Rama. However, in the end, she has her ultimate victory. She claims her authority, and she makes the decision to return to the earth. Now, turning to the myths of Vrindavan, the pastoral romance of Krishna and the gopis, we find that Radha is of great significance, particularly through the eyes of the bhakti mystics, and that some bhaktis have gone so far as to say that Radha is much more central, because if Krishna is the beloved, Radha is the lover, and the lover, after all, is the locus in which love manifests. All of the experience happens in her heart. And if one studies the literature of the bhakti tradition, for example, the Gita Govinda, she is the leading voice. Her experience defines the myth. And then in the case of Parvati, here too, if one studies the lore superficially, she seems secondary. In the Shiva Shastras, Shiva's teachings are presented in the form of dialogues in which Parvati appears as the chela, the disciple, and she is taught, instructed by Shiva. But if we look deeper, we see that she is not merely passively receiving teachings, she is asking questions, and her questions are cues, and those cues basically elicit the wisdom that Shiva has to offer. And if it were not for her role in this regard, Shiva would offer nothing. Moreover, Shiva is something of an antisocial wild man with very destructive tendencies. But through Parvati, he is largely domesticated, and his destructive power is put to very positive ends. Now, turning to the case of Buddhism, I can tell you that from my own experience, about 22 years ago, I was living in the foothills of the Himalayas and studying Buddhism under the auspices of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. I used to attend daily Dharma lectures and occasionally meet with His Holiness. And in the course of those studies, I believe it was in the course of studying a commentary on Shantideva's Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, I encountered the statement that women cannot attain enlightenment, or rather, enlightenment cannot be attained in a woman's body. A woman can accumulate meritorious karma, but she will have to be reborn as a man in order to attain ultimate enlightenment. So when I heard that, it struck me as a little odd. And the next time that I had the privilege of an interview with His Holiness, I raised that question. I said, is it true that women, enlightenment is impossible in a woman's body? And he said, it was true. It was true before Tara. And he said, Tara is the world's first feminist. And then he burst out laughing. It was an unforgettable moment, a joyous moment, because he didn't contradict the tradition. He said it was true, but somehow he made an accommodation for a much larger perspective. And it went straight into my heart. His words went into my heart. So Tara is emblematic of the power of the feminine within the Buddhist tradition. We may also look to the aunt of Gautama Buddha, Mahaprajapati Gotami, who was the sister of the mother of the Buddha and who was the foster mother of the Buddha who raised him and later was requested ordination and was refused again and again, but persisted in insisting that she receive that privilege. And she and a band of women continued to ask for that right until finally the Buddha conceded it under some very limiting circumstances, under some very limiting terms. So she was very tenacious in ensuring that that women have a full part to play in this, what she saw as this crucial dispensation of women. She did not want to reject it because she was rejected, and yet she had to find a modus vivendi, a way for women to participate fully. Now, in the Beni Israeli tradition, the Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition, there are many feminine exemplars. The first, of course, is Eve. And the case of Eve is another case of a woman getting a very bad name. Of course, Eve is identified as the agent of humanity's downfall into sin, the original temptress. And moreover, the creation of Eve has conventionally been imagined as a kind of an afterthought, that Eve was created from a rib of Adam as something secondary. So those perspectives, of course, continue to reverberate in the collective culture and have very serious implications for women. However, mystics have continuously challenged those assumptions without feeling the need to overturn the essential myth itself, the myth of Eve's creation. An example of this is the 16th century occultist Cornelius Agrippa, who wrote a treatise on the dignity of women. And he said that Adam's name comes from Adama, which means soil, the soil of the earth, whereas Eve's name, Hawa, comes from life. So that suggests some great eminence. And he also says that although conventionally it is said that since Eve was created from a rib of Adam, she's something secondary, he says no, Adam was created from inanimate substance, but Eve was a further creation from the animate substance of the first human being, a further perfection. And moreover, he says that creation was sequential, and that in the full course of creation, it is extremely significant that Eve is the final creation, the ultimate creation, after which God rested. So he writes, "For when the Creator came to the creation of woman, he rested himself in this creation, thinking that he had nothing more honorable to create. In her were completed and consummated all the wisdom and power of the Creator. After her, no creation could be found or imagined. Since, therefore, woman is the ultimate end of creation, the most perfect accomplishment of all the works of God, and the perfection of the universe itself, who will deny that she possesses honor surpassing every other creature?" And now, as to the question of Eve's role as an agent of humanity's fall, of course, the Sufi mystics have a special insight into the fall and consider it as providential. Halaj and Ain al-Quzat Hamadani have explained how Iblis operated under divine direction to guide humanity into this condition of estrangement, which is also a condition of that of a pioneer into new realms of possibility. And so Hazrat Nayat Khan says, Hazrat Nayat Khan reflects on both of these aspects of Eve, actually. Reflecting on her coming after the creation of Adam, he says, "In man we have designed our image, in woman we have finished it." Mm. And with respect to the question of the fall, he says in the Gayan, "Hail to my exile from the Garden of Eden to the earth. If I had not fallen, I should not have had the opportunity of probing the depths of life." Of course, the Hebrew Bible invokes many women prophets, and the Talmud identifies seven women prophets as primary: Sarah, Miriam, Deborah, Hannah, Abigail, Huldah, and Esther. And according to one tradition, there are 60,000 male prophets and 60,000 female prophets. It is said that Sarah, in the rabbinical literature, in the Israeliyat, it is said that Sarah was a greater prophet than Abraham, had greater prophetic insight. And of course, both Sarah and Hagar are figures of tremendous inspiration and significance, and they are the foremothers of two great civilizations, the Hebrews and the Arabs. The Arabs are the descendants of Hajar, who was exiled from the family of Abraham into the desert and left in the desert carrying her small child, Ismail. And she was, by the divine guidance, she was shown water, and that water became the well that is now known as Zemzem. And in her desperate searching for that water, she circumscribed an area of land that has become sacred land, that is the place where Mecca now exists, and where later Abraham came and with Ismail constructed the Kaaba. So that was a place that was, let's say, sanctified through Hajra's exile. Now the rivalry between Sarah and Hagar continues to reverberate down the generations as a source of tension, which continues to have serious consequences in the flashpoint of Jerusalem and Palestine. And there is a need within this vision of planetary prophetology to heal these ancient wounds and bring unity once again. Reb Zalman tells me that, according to some rabbinical commentators, the woman that Abraham married after the death of Sarah, named Keturah, is Hagar under another name, and so that Abraham and Hagar were reconciled in the end. But the Muslims, as they expanded out from Mecca, were first known, interestingly enough, as Magarite or Magre or Muhajirun, which are all names that contain two references. One is the reference to Hajar, to Hagar, as their ancient matriarch. And the other reference is to the experience of exile, which is the exile of Hagar, but also the exile of the early Muslim communities who had to seek refuge outside of Mecca. So they were known as the descendants of Hagar, the branch of prophecy that flows through this line. Now, in the Christian sphere, the figure of Jesus is so powerful that the relationship between Father and Son is primary. And yet there has been felt a deep need for the balancing of the masculinity of that relationship of Father and Son by means of the presence of the mother. And the mother, of course, is Mary, the mother of Jesus. And she is significant particularly for her attribute of the Immaculate Conception. And the story of the Immaculate Conception, as told in the Gospel of Luke, tells of how the angel descended to present to her the good tidings of the prospect of the advent of Jesus through her womb. But she is not merely the object of this act, but she is a willing and conscious participant. She is invited, so to speak, and she answers that invitation with a fiat of consent. This is her fiat, her decision, her judgment, in which she gives her consent wholeheartedly and says, "Let it be." And that act, where she consciously, wholeheartedly opens herself to this role, represents a synergy. That is the metaphysical term for this act of hers, a synergy between human will and divine will, a perfect instance of the harmonization of the free will of the human being acting in consort with the wisdom of the divine plan. So she symbolizes synergy. She also symbolizes the paradoxical conjunction of fertility and purity. She is virginal, but she is also creative and fertile. She's a virgin and a mother. And therefore, she reminds all of us, whether male or female, that to be human does not mean no longer to be angelic, and to be angelic means not to be no longer human. That we live on multiple dimensions of reality, and her Immaculate Conception represents the wholeness of an identity that includes these multiple dimensions. So she is the perfect expression of the coinciding of innocence and experience. Of course, when her virginity has been fixated upon as a purely literal physical phenomenon, then her example can give to women the impression of an unattainable ideal. The idea of being fertile and virginal is one that Mary performs as, so to speak, alone of her sex. And if this understanding becomes too literal, then women feel constantly degraded by comparison and sullied and impure by comparison with this pure archetype of perfection. But we need not understand Mary's perfection in those terms. We can understand this in the mystical sense in which I have described and fully recognize Mary's physical womanhood and experience as a woman. And women in the Christian tradition, women mystics, have articulated a spiritual vision that is distinct from the spiritual vision that male medieval mystics described. The writings of women mystics in the Middle Ages reveal an ability to express personal experiences, whereas the male mystical writings often tend to represent doctrinal abstractions. The writings of medieval Christian women mystics speak about what happened to me, what I felt, a bodily physical experience. Now we come to the case of Islam. And here we confront a question. Does Islam recognize women prophets? That is a question. Now, on one side of the question, we have this evidence that in Surah Yusuf, it is said, we did not send before you as prophets any illa rijalan, except men. So that is a verse of the Quran. But how do we understand this verse? First of all, we know that in English, the word man or mankind has often been used generically to refer to humanity. So when we read particularly documents from prior eras, whenever we read the word man or mankind, we have to understand by that humanity as a whole. And so we can certainly understand, it is quite justifiable to interpret this verse in the sense that we have not sent prophets who are simply supernatural beings, extraterrestrials. We have sent to you human beings, humans like you, people of your own land. So that is a legitimate way to understand this verse. Now, As additional evidence, we can turn to Surah Al-Anbiya, the Surah of the Prophets. And in this Surah, there is an invocation of a series of prophets. Just as the name of the Surah is the Surah of the Prophets, as you might expect, a number of prophets are invoked in the Surah. And these prophets are Abraham, Noah, David, Solomon, Job, Ishmael, Idris, Dhul-Kifl, Jonah, Zechariah, John, and finally, a figure is mentioned who is feminine, who is a woman, Mary. So this also needs to be seriously weighed as evidence that in a long list of prophets, at the end comes the person of Mary in a surah whose title is the Prophets. So there is certainly no conclusive scriptural evidence in Islam that women cannot be acknowledged as holders of the prophetic function, and there seems to be evidence that, on the contrary, it is not only a possibility but an actuality. So now I want to come to a conclusion. In conclusion, we can say that although recorded history shows a prevalent pattern wherein women have been frequently, consistently marginalized, denied positions of power, nonetheless, in all of the major prophetic traditions, including those that were revealed within this historical phase of misogyny, the divine feminine continues to be affirmed. And that specifically it has been the role of the mystics to retrieve and reaffirm the significance of the feminine in conceiving the divine. We can also say that the mystics have recognized that prophecy itself is mediated by a feminine emanation, the Sakina. And moreover, that the mystics of multiple religions have recognized innumerable women as qualified with the attribute of prophethood. So the task for our time in envisioning the planetary prophetology of today is to consolidate this acknowledgement and retrieve as much as possible the vestiges of the voices of the women masters, saints, and prophetic figures, and thereby redress the imbalance that continues to persist to this day. Finally, it should also be said that the spiritual traditions of the world have frequently reflected the protocols and tendencies of the mainstream society. It has not been possible even for the mystics to operate in a vacuum, and that mystical organizations and traditions have made concessions. And the consequence has been a much larger scale of male participation in sacred practice versus female. Now, this is changing in our time. Of course, females have great personalities, of course, have challenged these norms and sometimes have suffered very serious consequences. But nonetheless, these norms have generally prevailed. But now there is the opportunity for change. Changes are afoot, as Murshid clearly saw, and women are participating in new ways. And women are undertaking disciplines of sacred practice that have been traditionally the exclusive purview of men. And so new questions are arising, because since men have been the transmitters of these forms, to what extent have those forms become customized to the particular disposition, biologically and culturally, of men? And to what extent are women now entering a man's sphere and needing, therefore, to express their own authentic articulations of that experience, and even in some case adapt the forms to reflect that experience? So the role of women in spirituality today is a pioneering role, as I suppose it is in many spheres of life. And within that pioneering role, there is great wisdom to draw upon from the past, many precedents, many examples of true feminine inspiration. But there is also a need to live with the questions of the present and look hopefully toward the future. So I hope that what I have shared today can be received as a modest contribution to that enormous and extremely important undertaking, and that this undertaking will require a serious conversation, an existential conversation, and that conversation has to include women at its very heart. And I see the signs of that emerging conversation, and that is where I place my trust. And if I have any word of suggestion to offer, it is that we all unite in bringing this conversation forward with humility, with clarity, with love, so that we can be part of the midwifery of the new planetary civilization that is waiting to be born. Thank you for your attention.